miracle of consciousness any more than I can turn my sword into a lightsaber.
Now that would be wicked cool. You could dress in one of those brown robes and trade insipid lines of dialogue with your Padawan, Granuel.
Not now, Oberon.
Admit it, you're vaguely disappointed with her calling you sensei. Secretly, you want her to call you master.
Gods below, go inside and chase the cats already. Begging your pardon, I said to the widow, would you mind if Oberon went inside for a bit?
Eh? No, me boy, not at all. Good exercise for me pussies. They're good dog-fearing cats.
Oberon chuffed.
I like it when they hiss at me, and it brings up a hairball.
Don't break anything in there.
Anything that breaks is always the cat's fault.
I let him in the front door and immediately heard his joyous barks and the terrified howling of the widow's cats. The widow and I chuckled over it together as I sat back down and she took a sip from her glass. So, do you think you could pray over that for me? I asked when the commotion inside died down a bit.
The Virgin Mary on Apache Boulevard? Sure I can, if it'll make your heart glad.
It would, I said. Don't forget to mention she could help me slay a demon escaped from hell. Pray hard, if there is such a thing, and focus on what she would look like, and when she'd do it, which is during the next couple of hours. And while you're at it, I'll give your grass a trim.
Attaboy,
she said, and smiled beatifically at me as I rose from my chair and trotted down the porch in search of her push lawnmower. I found it in the garage and hauled it out for a bit of brisk exercise as the widow shut her eyes and began to rock softly in her chair. I didn't know if this would work, but I had hope. Mary tended to make a lot more visits than the rest of the Christian saints and angels, and in the dozen or so times I'd run across her, it was always a result of some prayer for intercession someone had made on behalf of a group of people. If it didn't work, then I wouldn't sweat it. I'd just take the arrows into a Catholic church and ask a priest to bless them. Anyone's strong Christian faith would be effective against the demon, but Mary's personal blessing would be quite a coup if I could count it. After finishing the lawn, I returned the mower to its place in the widow's garage and joined her on the porch. Her eyes opened after a moment, and there were tears welling up in them.
Ah, Atticus, I do hope she heard me and comes on down like you say. I know she's been looking after me, Sean, God rest him.
She crossed herself at the mention of her deceased husband.
But I don't think he'd mind if she popped out for a bit to help some souls down here going through a dark patch right now. 'Twould be a mighty blessing, and that's no lie. But whether she comes or no, it does me heart good to think she might, and that there's hope for those benighted people who might find God in the kindness of her smile. Thank ye for suggesting the prayer to me.
I took the widow's small, spotted hand and gave it a brief squeeze. We sat together on the porch and watched the storm clouds boil in from the east until it was time for me to meet Coyote.
Off ye go, then,
the widow said when I made my farewell, and told Oberon it was time to leave the cats alone.
Tell Mary I love her if you see her. Oh, and Atticus, me boy.
Yes, Mrs. McDonough?
Maybe you should wear a helmet this time,
she teased me,
in case the demon wants to nibble on your nose or something.
Chapter 8 Coyote was only 5 minutes late. The tires of a Ford Escape hybrid squealed as he rounded the corner. He braked sharply in front of my house, marking the pavement and sending up the smell of burned rubber. He got out of the cab and laughed.
This here is one hot ride, Mr. Druid. Yes, sirree.
He slapped the hood a couple of times to punctuate his enthusiasm. You really think so? I think something sportier would be more fun to drive than that.
I meant hot, as in freshly stolen. Stealing cars is almost as fun as stealing horses used to be a couple of centuries ago. You ready?
Yep. I held my bow, and the quiver of arrows was strapped to my back. Oberon was all set up inside with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on DVD. I'd promised to get him the audiobook version later, so that he could appreciate the trip from inside Chief Bromden's head. Did you remember to bring a bow?
Sure did. And I got me a squirt gun filled with holy water for laughs.
All right, then. Mind if I drive? Coyote laughed.
Sure, Mr. Druid. This is your rodeo. I can't wait to see where you're gonna find us some holy arrows.
Arrows are right here, I said, jerking a thumb over my shoulder at my quiver. They're just not holy yet. Coyote laughed again.
You're just gonna dip 'em in holy water, aren't ya?
Maybe. I grinned to hide my irritation. Maybe not. Wait and see. Apache Boulevard wasn't nearly as bad as Mos Eisley. After the light rail was built, developers began to reinvest in the area and relieve some of the urban blight. But there were still stretches of low-rent trailer parks and cheap stucco boxes that passed for shelter, unpaved driveways and yards full of soiled mattresses and rusted car parts. Visual cues in America that signify poverty and discord and a spiritual wasteland. At a few minutes after 10 in the morning, all the meth addicts were asleep and there was very little for Mary to do. The people walking around Apache Boulevard at that time all had someplace to go. They all had a shred of hope in their lives. Nevertheless, there was a small knot of people crowded around her when I saw a navy blue dress and white headband between Martin Lane and River Drive. There were even a few stray dogs and some alley cats rubbing up against her legs, as if they were gentle domestics. To double-check whether I was looking at a true manifestation of Mary, I activated a charm on my necklace that I call Fairy Specs. It's a spell that shows me what's going on in the magical and supernatural spectrum, if there's anything more to look at than the normal collection of proteins, minerals, and water.
Oh!
I squeezed my eyes and turned off the specs immediately, jerking the wheel of the Ford a bit.
What's wrong, Mr. Druid?
Coyote asked. I blinked and saw spots.
That's definitely the Virgin. Bright white light.
I turned the Ford into the first driveway I saw and put it in park. It was the entrance to a decrepit trailer park, covered in gravel and broken glass. Nothing grew there but misery and despair, the people living there cut off from nature and walking the world unbound from it. Coyote and I got out, and I retrieved my quiver of arrows from the cargo area. As we approached, Mary was blessing a large Latino man dressed like a tough guy. A vato loco would be the slang term. He wore a blue bandana and dark sunglasses, even though it was completely overcast, and his gray flannel shirt was buttoned only at the top, leaving a white t-shirt to show underneath. Tears were streaming out from underneath the sunglasses. "Your pardon, ma'am, but I wonder if you would mind blessing these arrows for us," I said. "We're off to fight a demon." She smiled and chuckled fondly as she addressed me.
"Child," she said.
She always called me that, even though I was older than she was.
"I came here with no other purpose in mind."
"The Widow McDonough wanted me to tell you she loves you," I said.
"Ah, Katie."
The Virgin's smile became even brighter.
"She prays to me daily, you know, and recently she's been asking to keep you safe. So you must remain safe, Mr. O'Sullivan, and return my love to her. She has a beautiful soul."
"Yes, she does."
"Let us see these arrows of yours."
Being careful with the fletching, I slowly drew the arrows out of the quiver together and then handed the quiver to Coyote. I presented them to the Virgin across both my arms so that the heads were pointed north to her right. She closed her eyes, laid her hands gently on the heads, and spoke a few lines from the benediction in the Latin Mass.
"O salutaris hostia quae quoli pandis hostium. Bella primunt hostilia, da robur fer auxilium."
The form of her blessing was rather unexpected. I was hoping for an original composition, but upon reflection I supposed it was an appropriate sentiment. "Our foes press on from every side. Thine aid supply, thine strength bestow." She held on to the arrows for about 10 seconds after she finished speaking. I'm sure if I had dared to use my fairy specs, I'd have seen some really interesting magic being woven around them. a split second before the light of the Virgin burned out my eyeballs. When she finished, she opened her eyes and released the slightest bit of tension that had built up in her shoulders. She smiled benignly upon me, and then widened it to include Coyote.
"The last of the Druids, and one of the first people of Native America, are off to fight a fallen angel from the Fifth Circle."
I'd been smiling back at Mary, until I processed the end of her sentence. At that point, I didn't know if I'd ever smile again. "A fallen angel? One of the original host?" Mary nodded.
"Yes. It is twisted and blackened now, the light of heaven snuffed out long ago."
"Ooh-wee, Mr. Druid. Sounds like powerful medicine to me,"
Coyote said. He wasn't kidding. Fallen angels weren't ordinary demons. I wasn't sure cold fire would even work against such a being, since they were condemned to spend eternity in hell rather than spawn there. "And the Fifth Circle," I said, "if I remember my Dante, is where the wrathful and the sullen are punished."
"That's correct, my child,"
Mary affirmed. "Gods below, how did Angus Og manage to summon something that powerful?" Mary beamed patiently at me, ignoring my invocation of a different pantheon.
"I do not think he summoned it so much as provided an avenue for its escape. Still, the binding placed on it as a condition of its egress is still in effect, and that is the only thing keeping it in this area."
"Meaning that it won't leave the East Valley until I'm dead," I said.
"Whoa, it sucks to be you, Mr. Druid."
Coyote chuckled and clapped me a couple of times on the shoulder.
"Here, give me those arrows."
He took them from my arms and placed them back in the quiver.
"I'll be waiting in the hot vehicle. This white lady's a bit too shiny for me."
"You have an interesting assortment of friends,"
Mary observed as Coyote's boots crunched away on the gravel.
"A Native American deity, a pack of lycanthropes, a vampire, and a coven of Zoria worshippers."
"I wouldn't call them all my friends," I said. "More like acquaintances. Mrs. McDonough and my dog Oberon are my friends."
"Then you have chosen your friends wisely,"
Mary said kindly.
"My work here is finished. Yours is just beginning, I fear. You will most likely need to pierce Bazazel more than once before he is undone."
"Bazazel?"
"That is his name. He was mighty before he fell with Lucifer."
"Christ," I whispered without thinking.
"My son is confident of your victory,"
Mary said. "No kidding? Tell Jesus I said hi, and we should have a beer next time he's in the neighborhood."
"I will relay your greetings. Now go, child. You have my blessing upon you."
"Peace be with you," I said, and as I turned to resume my journey with Coyote, I added under my breath, "An ass-kicking be with me." Chapter 9.
"I gotta admit, Mr. Druid, I didn't think we'd be seeing anything like that. You kind of surprised me. How'd you know that shiny white lady'd be there?"
Coyote was dressed the same way as I had seen him the night before, except now he was wearing dark sunglasses. His expressions tended to run to either amused or inscrutable, and right now he was showing me the latter. Perhaps he mistrusted me. I shrugged my shoulders as I steered the SUV south to US 60. I just had faith, I guess.
"Pfft. You don't have any more faith than I do for the Christian folks."
I felt myself slipping automatically back into the rhythms of Coyote's speech.
"Yeah, but I had faith in a Catholic friend of mine. She did the praying for me." "Well then, why didn't she just pray for Jesus to come down and smite the demon or something? We could have slept in."
"'Cause Jesus don't like to come down very much. People keep thinking of him being nailed to a cross or wearing a crown of thorns, or else he's got huge bloody holes in his hands and feet, and that's just gotta be damn uncomfortable. Plus, they think he was a white guy with straight brown hair,
but he was dark-skinned. Shucks, I bet you know what that's like. When people think of you like one of them stylized sand paintings or a fetish animal. You don't want to go prancing around looking like that, do you?
Hell no,
Coyote grinned.
I tried appearing as one of those sand paintings once. My body was so stretched out, I completely lost track of where my ass was.
We shared a laugh over that as we turned east onto US 60, and the clouds that had been threatening to dump on us all morning finally let loose. Big, fat drops splattered noisily on our vehicle, and it reminded me of those drum rolls you hear before a circus acrobat does something remarkably stupid without a net. I had difficulty figuring out how to turn on the windshield wipers, and Coyote sniggered at me until I got them.
So, how many fallen angels you killed afore this, Mr. Druid?
This'll be my first, I reckon.
Shit.
Coyote shook his head with a rueful grin.
We're gonna die.
I looked sharply at him. Are you approaching this like a suicide trip? You figuring it's okay to die and leave me there without no one to watch my back, because you can just come back from the dead anyway? I tell you right now, Coyote, I'm planning on living a long time after this. If you ain't planning on surviving, tell me straight, and I'll go get someone else to help me.
Ah, cool your britches, Mr. Druid. I ain't gonna walk up to him and ask him to eat me.
Coyote threw up his hands.
All I'm saying is this ain't gonna be no picnic. A fallen angel's gonna be a far sight smarter than a regular demon, and more'n a little stronger, too.
All right, then. You got any idea where the demon is?
Last I saw, he was perched on one of their buildings overlooking a courtyard area. It's got some grass and trees in it, so you can draw power there.
We're gonna have to go through the school building to get there, though.
That's what I expect.
We'll have to go camouflaged. School officials tend to get worried about people bringing weapons onto their campuses. Skyline High School is a monolithic building of stucco-sprayed cement block trimmed in hunter green. I parked in the no-parking drop-off zone because I just didn't care about parking etiquette. I cast camouflage on both myself and Coyote, then got out and opened the cargo area, where I camouflaged both our bows, the quiver of arrows, and Fraggeraw too. It didn't make us completely invisible, especially in the rain, but it sure helped. Once inside, we'd blend into the bland institutional decor without trouble. Coyote pitched in by giving us something he called clever stalking, which really meant we wouldn't make any noise when we moved. I'm not sure why he didn't call it silent stalking. I suppose Coyote thought it was clever of him to think stalking should be a silent exercise. We glided by the reception desk without disturbing the matronly woman sitting there. She seemed to be emotionally involved with a game of solitaire on her computer. There were two full-time employees working at the attendance window, because taking attendance and getting money from the state is the most important job at public schools. But they were listening to parents lie on the phone about why their children weren't in school that day, so they weren't even looking up to see what was dripping all across the industrial carpet in the hallway. The doors to the courtyard gave a high-pitched squeak when we opened them, and the sound of pouring rain caused the attendance clerks to look up, but we slipped out without them spotting us. Class was in session, and the courtyard was deserted. We were underneath a roofed area that traveled around the perimeter, providing shelter for rare rainy days like this, but usually offering shade the rest of the year. Thick ropes of runoff water slapped noisily on the concrete before coursing in swift rivulets toward drainage grates. I turned on my fairy specs and had no trouble figuring out where Bazazel was lurking. He was directly across from us, perched on the steel roof in a Doppler-shifted cloud of wrong. The feathered wings he had eons ago were now leathery and bat-like. The rest of him was still humanoid in appearance, just blackened and spiky and pulsing with evil, like a subwoofer vibrating a car's windows and blurring the view. What made him particularly repellent at the moment was his open mouth, out of which dangled another teenage victim's leg. Some poor kid who'd been on his way to the nurse's office, perhaps, or called down to see the counselor. As we watched, the fallen angel's teeth crunched down and his lower jaw slid sideways in a grotesque chewing motion. Coyote saw it at the same time I did.
"Too late to help that one, I reckon,"
he whispered to my right. I couldn't see him in the normal spectrum, but with my fairy specs on, he looked like a colorful collection of light streams, shifting chaotically within his form, but not unpleasantly, just unpredictably. I handed him 6 arrows out of the quiver.
"I'll put my first arrow through his head. You go for the heart," I whispered back. "Then just keep shooting until he fucking dies."
"Wow. You learn all that strategy from the U.S. Army men?"
I grunted in amusement.
"No, I learned it from Attila the Hun, who lived and died without ever knowing you were here."
The two of us drifted apart naturally, hunters of old. We did not need to discuss strategy. When it's 2 against 1, the two should separate so that if the target counterattacks one, his back is left open to the other. When we'd formed a triangle, Coyote and I at the base and Bazazel at the top, we knocked our arrows and nodded at each other. I slid out of my sandals and stepped into the rain so that I could draw power from the earth. First, I filled my bear charm back up, in case I needed to cast something on the sidewalk. Then I drew enough to pull back the bow, just as Bazazel was finishing off his teenage repast. I held up 5 fingers to Coyote, folded in my thumb, then my index finger to indicate a countdown, then pulled the bowstring to its limit. I took quick aim and let fly in time with the countdown. I was already grabbing another arrow as our first volley sank home. My arrow pierced the fallen angel's left eye, and Coyote's thudded solidly into the center of its chest. It screeched on several wavelengths and shuddered my bones as it toppled backward onto the roof, surprised and clutching at the shafts. Normally, if you shoot something in the head with an arrow, it doesn't have enough motor skills left to reach up and pluck the arrow out. And shooting a critter in the heart generally robs it of the strength to stand up and roar defiantly at unsafe decibel levels. Bazazel wasn't normal, for he did both of those things. A white, bubbling wound was left behind in each case, but the fallen angel threw both the arrows down into the courtyard, spread his wings, and crouched in preparation to spring at one of us. He saw us both clearly. My camouflage spell kept us hidden from human eyes, but not from his.
"How many arrows we gotta use to kill this thing?"
Coyote yelled.
"All Mary said was we'd have to pierce it more'n once."
"Yeah? Well, maybe you should have pinned her down to a specific number there afore we left, dumbass."
I agreed with Coyote wholeheartedly, as we let fly with another volley. Bazazel knocked Coyote's missile aside with a blurred sweep of his left arm, but mine sank directly into his swollen gut. The force of it toppled him backward again, but this time he knew better than to stay still and let us reload. Ignoring the arrow that was turning his black skin into a white froth before bubbling away to gray, he gathered his legs underneath him and launched himself straight up into the air with a single, powerful stroke of his wings and another mighty bellow of rage I could feel in my teeth. At the apex of his ascent, he folded his wings and dove after his chosen target. Me. The eternal whine of self-pity, "Why me?" flashed through my brain as I aimed one last shot at the fallen angel. The answers came flooding in. I looked like nothing more than a puny human weakling. I'd shot him in the head and the gut. I was standing in the open, where he could get to me easily, while Coyote was shooting from underneath the shelter of the roof. And because of the binding Angus Oak had put on him, he couldn't leave the area until he killed me. I let fly with my shot, and it sailed above his right shoulder, much to my chagrin. Dropping my bow because there'd be no time for another shot, I leapt back under the roof and drew Fragorol with my right hand and another blessed arrow from my quiver with my left. I positioned myself behind one of the roof's supporting steel posts so that Bazazel would have to pick a side to attack from and reduce his speed accordingly. It turned out the post was not something he considered to be an actual obstacle. He simply bashed it aside with his right arm as his wings spread to break his flight, and the post obligingly ripped out of its moorings and buckled a portion of the roof as if it were made of nerf rather than steel.
"Don't you feel the least bit ill right now?"
I asked. I could see the courtyard through the yawning white hole in his head. It was still boiling and hissing, eating away at his substance, as were the other two wounds, but in terms of real damage, it only seemed to have pissed him off. His feet touched down on the concrete rather than the earth, so cold fire was out of the question. He answered me by belching a gout of bright orange flame at my face. It looked exactly like the ball of hellfire Angus Og had thrown at me.
"Hey!"
I shouted as the flame passed over me, giving me a brief sensation of heat, but otherwise leaving me unharmed, thanks to my amulet's protection.
"You're the bastard who made a deal with Angus Og. You're the one who's been behind it all."
I heard the squeal of the office doors opening to my right. Someone was coming out to investigate what all the ruckus was. They wouldn't be able to see me or the demon, but they'd sure see the mangled post lying in the rain and a dangerously drooping roof. They'd also be in mortal danger. It's the sort of situation that gets duelists killed. A split second of distraction, flicking the eyes away for a shadow of a moment, and suddenly it's all over. Bazazel was counting on it. Perhaps he saw my eyes move, perhaps he didn't, but he shook off his surprise that I didn't burn and took advantage anyway. He was still a good 4 feet away from me, but his right arm shot toward my chest, and his fingers extended, then his claws did likewise, telescope fashion, aiming for my heart. He wanted to pull one of those Mola Ram maneuvers, ripping my still-beating heart out of my chest and then laughing at me as I watched him eat it. I dodged to my right as quickly as I could, raising my left arm to let the claws pass under, but I wasn't quick enough. I felt 4 rotten black spikes pierce my side, scraping against the outside of my ribs, and penetrating clear through to keep me pinned to the wall. I grunted in pain and retaliated quickly, because part of him was pinned too. I drove the tip of the blessed arrow down through the back of his corrupted hand and on through the palm. He howled and yanked his hand away, withdrawing the evil claws from my side, and in that moment of reprieve, I risked a quick glance to my right. A wide-eyed female administrator in conservative dress was talking rapidly into a handheld radio.
"There's some damage to the courtyard roof and some strange animal noises, but I can't tell what's making them."
"Get back inside, lady," I yelled, "for your own safety."
That was the best I could do for her just then. Bazazel looked as if he was going to move in closer and tear my head off, so I raised Fragorol in a defensive stance and winced at the burning in my side. As the fallen angel bent his knees and hissed at me, arms spread in a wrestler stance, preparing to spring, it occurred to me that maybe Coyote should have managed to shoot an arrow or two during the fracas. Where was the trickster? Had he taken off and left me to face the fallen angel alone? He'd been known to do that in several stories told about him. Get the white man to agree to a course of action, then take off at the critical moment and make him look like a fool. I didn't know what more I could do to this creature by myself. 4 holy arrows had obviously done some physical damage. He'd loudly announced that he felt pain from them, but he still kept coming. A morbid thought wandered into my consciousness and said hello. If Bazazel ate my dumb druid ass, would the Morrigan be able to bring me back fully functional, resurrected from... what? Angel poop? That raised another question, at once metaphysical and profane. Do angels, fallen or otherwise, have assholes? Coyote provided an answer in singular fashion. I heard a sickening, juicy, squelching noise, and Bazazel forgot all about charging me. He stood straight up on his clawed toes, feet together like a wooden nutcracker doll, his black eyes bulging and his throat ululating in a banshee howl of agony that made me clutch my ears. Or rather, my one good ear and my one mess of pathetic cartilage niblets. Coyote shouted, "Ha!" once, and then began to yip in amusement, scampering across the courtyard in his animal shape, taunting the fallen angel, and Bazazel launched himself skyward to give chase. While he was thus diverted, I took the opportunity to sheath Fraggaraw and grab the school administrator by the collar, dragging her back to the office doors. She yelped in startlement, and I shouted at her as I tossed her inside. "Put the school in lockdown now! Just do it before someone else gets killed!" Every school in America had a lockdown procedure they followed to keep students safe in an emergency.
"What? Who got killed?"
"Take attendance and you'll find out. It's what you're best at, because the gods know it's not teaching them English. Damn kids don't know the difference between an adjective and an adverb." I needed to shut up. Stress was making me take my frustrations out on this poor, frumpy lady, who probably never got laid.
"Who are... Why can't I see you?"
"Lockdown! Attendance! Stay inside!" I slammed the door shut for extra emphasis, and hoped that would galvanize her to the proper course of action. Turning back to the courtyard, I saw that Bazazel was trying to fry Coyote from the air with his great balls of fire. Coyote was thus far a mite too fast for him, but I wasn't sure how long that would last, or if Coyote would be able to withstand a direct hit of hellfire. I scurried over to where I'd dropped my bow in the courtyard. It was still camouflaged, so I couldn't see it, and it took me a few frantic moments to stumble into it. The act of bending over to pick it up exacerbated the wounds in my side, and duly reminded of them, I drew power to close them up and begin the tissue-mending process. 2 arrows left. Coyote had presumably dropped the remainder of his somewhere. I knocked one and tried not to laugh at the image of Bazazel flying around with a feathery shaft sticking out between his cheeks. I chose my own target carefully, and the bowstring thwacked as the arrow sailed up and through the fallen angel's right wing. It tore a magnificent white hole through it and began to widen, which caused Bazazel to screech and tumble ignominiously to the earth, precisely where I wanted him.
"Doi!"
I shouted, pointing my right index finger at him and drawing strength from the earth as I cast cold fire. I immediately felt weaker, as if I were suffering from low blood sugar. My muscles were like leaden weights and sluggish to obey my commands. It wasn't as bad as the first time I'd cast it, when I completely collapsed from the effort, but it was a fact that I wouldn't be pulling that bowstring again today. I'd have to lie down and spend some time recuperating. The school's loudspeaker crackled to life, and a stern voice of authority boomed metallically off the courtyard walls.
"Teachers, please go into lockdown at this time. Once again, teachers, please go into lockdown immediately."
Apparently, the repeated unholy shrieks from Bazazel and random jets of flame in the courtyard had convinced the administration something was amiss, and this, on top of the commands delivered from a mysterious disembodied voice who seemed dissatisfied with the school's English instruction, compelled them to act. Bazazel began to rise slowly from the ground, the arrows clearly and finally bothering him now. As yet, he betrayed no sign that the cold fire was working on him, but I had hope it would take effect in short order. Coyote, returned to human form, had dashed back to where his bow and arrows were and called to me.
"What'd you do to him, Mr. Druid?"
"I'm not sure if I did anything," I called back. "You might want to shoot him a couple more times."
"Oh yeah, that brilliant strategy you learned from Attila the Hun. Almost forgot."
As Coyote knocked an arrow and began to pull the bowstring, Bazazel was ripping the arrows from his hand and his belly and making horrible noises in the process. He was gingerly trying to deal with the final arrow. Mercutio's phrase about the blind bowboy's butt shaft took on a new meaning in this situation. When Coyote's shot took him straight in the throat, choking off all further screams, it allowed us to hear the sound of approaching police sirens.
"Yeah," Coyote whooped and pumped his fist. "Sit down and have a tall glass of shut the hell up."
I was quickly turning loopy because, as the fallen angel was non-verbally communicating his distress with an impressive array of spastic twitches and concomitant white ejecta from his wounds, I was thinking, it's too bad we'll never get a chance to talk over a cup of tea. Besides the Morrigan, I rarely had conversations with beings older than I was, and I treasured them whenever they happened along. My doubts about whether cold fire would work on a fallen angel were soon allayed. The bubbling mess inside Bazazel's wounds began to spread all over his body, so that his legs and arms were roiling like maggots running rampant under a corpse's skin. The next second, he tried to curl inward on himself in a mockery of the fetal position, and then he exploded in a slimy mass of purulence and gore. His tar-like substance polluted the courtyard, covering grass, trees, steel, and cement alike, with the remains of the partially digested teenager splattered liberally amongst the mess. The falling rain was a benediction now, for the earth had been cleansed of an ancient evil, but it would never be able to wash this away before school got out, much less before the cops got here.
"That's right, son,"
Coyote shouted at the remains.
"You don't come into my house and expect to live."
"By Balor's evil eye, what are we going to do about all this goo?" I said.
"What's this we you talking about, Mr. Druid? Ain't my demon, and it ain't my mess."
"Yeah, I know, but I can't get any ghouls out here now to clean it up. People are going to have to deal with it and rationalize it away somehow. They can call the Ghostbusters to take a sample of the ectoplasmic discharge or whatever, or they'll have to bring in Mulder and Scully, because there ain't no CSI on the planet that'll ever be able to explain this."
"I have no idea what you're talking about, Mr. Druid."
I didn't care to explain. I just pointed at the carnage and said, "This right here will be the birthplace of 1,000 conspiracy theories about aliens and most likely a sign of the coming apocalypse. You watch. It'll be in the Weekly World News." Coyote shrugged.
"Hey, I don't care. It'll be a damn funny story, whatever they come up with."
"We should get the arrows," I said. "Better not leave them lying around."
"Yeah, good idea,"
Coyote replied. I put my sandals back on before venturing out to wade amongst the hellish mess, then joined Coyote in tracking down the arrows. Police officers began to stream into the courtyard, but we kept our mouths shut, knowing that they wouldn't be able to hear us or see us, except as a flicker of movement they'd dismiss as a trick of the rain. Once the quiver was full again, we dodged around a few police officers and administrative types to get back to the office door. I remembered one last detail before we left the scene. I had to get rid of any blood that may have dropped after Bazazel stabbed me. I found a few drops near the wall, not as much as I'd feared. It had mostly been soaked up by my shirt. I grabbed a few handfuls of water from the continuing runoff and washed it away, erasing evidence for the coming forensic specialists and leaving nothing behind for witches. The bell rang, signaling the end of class and beginning of lunchtime. Since the school was in lockdown, the kids would remain in class and simply go hungry for a while. But they'd be safe now. Feeling pretty good about ourselves, the two of us walked back through the office building to our stolen SUV waiting in the drop-off zone. It was surrounded by police cars. Oh well. We kept the camouflage on and walked south, thoroughly drenched and starting to get cold.
"There's another high school just south of the freeway,"
Coyote explained once we were a safe distance from the office, lazily gesturing down Crisman Road.
It's called Desert Ridge. Parking lot full of unattended cars there to steal.
Think I'll just call myself a taxi at that convenience store there, I replied, pointing to a friendly red and white logo glowing dimly through the rain. I've caused enough grief for high school students today. These poor skyline... What are they? I couldn't think of their mascot, and I turned back to their marquee sign to check. It said, Home of the Coyotes, and I swore in Old Irish with such prolixity my father would have been proud. Coyote was already laughing and putting distance between us. He knew I'd be annoyed at being tricked, and I was. Not in your house, eh? Did one of the Dene even die back there? I challenged him. You lied to me about that maiden getting eaten, didn't you?
Yep. Only white people died.
Coyote grinned wickedly.
But I didn't want to let you wait around until one of my people became his breakfast, because I do have some of my people at this school, and I did want to protect them.
So you put me at tremendous risk. I wasn't really ready to confront this guy. I wanted to take him on at my place of power on my own terms.
Now don't be mad, Mr. Druid. I helped you take care of a big problem. You might have not made it if it weren't for me.
Yeah, what about that? You took your sweet time getting round to helping when he came after me.
Well, you know, I just couldn't resist doing it the way I did it. You know how people are always threatening to shove this or that up someone's ass, but they never really do it? Well, now there's a new story gonna be told round the fire. How Coyote shoved an arrow up a fallen angel's ass. Can't wait to hear myself tell it. And don't you worry, Mr. Druid. I'll make sure to include how I got the best of you.
He melted into his animal form and trotted off into the rain, yipping his merriment and grinning back at me over his shoulder. Chapter 10. I spent most of the cab ride home muttering about thrice-cursed trickster gods, but by the end of it, I was smiling in spite of myself. I wasn't the first guy who'd been tricked by Coyote, and I wouldn't be the last. I'd actually gotten off pretty lightly, walking away with nothing more than a flesh wound. Lunch with Oberon was unusually relaxing, perhaps because I'd rid myself of a large piece of unfinished business. My hound had 5 vice-versed sausages, and I had peanut butter and orange marmalade on wheat with a glass of milk. Oberon wanted to discuss what he'd seen in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, how Nurse Ratched was really the man, and how Wavy Gravy would have shown her a thing or two if he'd been there. He wanted to talk about where Chief Bromden went at the end, whether I thought he went back to the Columbia River, or whether he might have gone out to fight against the Combine. He also, very somberly, wanted to talk about end-of-life decisions.
If the man ever cuts out half my brain, and I'm a vegetable like McMurphy, he said, then I want you to do what Chief did, okay?
I didn't know what to say. Chief had smothered McMurphy with a pillow. I unexpectedly teared up just thinking about it, and scratched him behind the ears. Then that wasn't enough, so I squatted down and gave him a hug. Oberon didn't know it, but he had already outlived every Irish wolfhound that had ever walked the earth. The tragedy of his magnificent breed is their fairly short lifespan, only 6 or 7 years. But I'd been giving Oberon the same blend of herbs and magic that kept me looking and feeling 21 instead of 2100, a brew I jokingly called immortality. Oberon was now 15, and had no idea that he should have been dead years ago, not running around with the energy and strength of a 3-year-old adult. Okay, buddy, I finally said. Before I could descend further into maudlin sentiment, my cell phone began to play Witchy Woman, an Eagles ringtone I'd downloaded especially for Melina's calls. I walked out to my backyard before answering it, deciding to recharge a bit while I spoke with her. She thanked me for the shipment of bloodwort and made polite noises about its superior quality. I made polite noises back, thanking her for her business. And I thought all the while that it was good to be back to our formal relationship. Then she got down to the business I wanted to hear.
We were able to confirm in last night's ritual that the Tochter der Stritten houses are here in the East Valley, but we were sadly unable to pinpoint their precise location.
Then you have both my congratulations and condolences. Any idea on why you couldn't get a clearer picture?
Perhaps our effectiveness is reduced with only 6 of us left. Perhaps they have cast some sort of cloak about themselves that we are unable to penetrate. Most likely it is a little bit of both, she said. We will try again tonight. Did you try divining their location yourself?
No, I haven't had the time to use my own methods, I said. Kinda had a busy morning. I ought to have some time to try after work.
I doubt you will have any time at all. We also performed our divination ritual to locate the Bakkens, and had much more success. They are here, 12 of them to be exact, and they plan to begin causing mischief in Scottsdale this evening. Saturnalian orgies will ensue unless you intervene.
Is it truly important I intervene tonight? I hadn't heard anything more from Laksha, and I might not have an effective way of doing so. What lasting damage could one night of true bacchanalia really do to Scottsdale?
Mr. O'Sullivan, bacchanalia will spread disease. It will ruin marriages and other relationships, causing untold emotional distress and greater economic damage through divorce. It encourages a lifestyle of reckless behavior and moral turpitude, and participants often become criminals in short order.
That sounds like a weekend at the Phoenix Open.
I am not joking. People occasionally die from their exertions, which we clearly cannot allow. And besides that, the Bakkens will significantly increase their numbers if unchecked, and you will have a bigger problem the longer you wait.
Well, wait a second. You said before that these Bakkens have been in Las Vegas for years.
That is correct.
Well then, why isn't Vegas all jacked up? Oh.
Yes?
I think the question answered itself. I beg your pardon.
Granted. They will be at the nightclub called Saturn on Scottsdale Road. It's fairly upscale. You will need to make an effort to appear a little less scruffy.
She was baiting me, but I wasn't going to bite. Will you say scruffy one more time for me, please?
Scruffy. Why?
I'm trying to learn your accent. Her voice grew chilly, and her accent became more pronounced.
I'm sure you have much more important things to do, as do I. Good day.
I grinned as I put away my phone. She was funny when she got herself in a snit. Biking to work actually took some effort on my part, drained as I was from using cold fire. I'd have to spend the night recuperating in the backyard to recharge my depleted cells. The widow waved to me as I trundled past.
Did you see Mary, then?
She called.
Sure did.
I gave her a thumbs up.
I'll come sit with you after work and tell you all about it.
Ah, that'll be grand.
The book side of Third Eye Books Nerves doesn't need much of my personal attention anymore. With automated inventory control, the computer orders another copy for me whenever I sell something. Perry Thomas, my employee for more than 2 years and the cheeriest goth kid I've ever met, could almost run the whole thing for me. He was always restocking Karen Armstrong's books, because they tended to move pretty well, along with books about Wicca and primers on Taoism or Zen Buddhism. What Perry cannot do is run the apothecary side of things, except on the most basic level. If I point to pre-made sachets of certain proprietary blended teas and say, add hot water, he's all over it, and he happily serves my arthritic customers who come in every day for a shot of mobility. But he cannot mix herbs on his own,
cannot recognize when we're low on one herb or have too much of another, and he's simply not allowed to sell bulk herbs to anyone because he's incapable of warning them about the herb's dangerous properties. He greeted me with a wave and a,
"Sup, Atticus,"
when I jangled the bells above my door. He was restocking some books that predicted the end of the world based on what loin-clothed Mayan mystics said 14 centuries ago. Granuel was sitting behind the apothecary counter, headphones jacked into a laptop, and practicing her Latin as I had asked. Only at it for a week, she was already able to trade basic sentences with me. She didn't hear the bells tingle due to the headphones, but she saw me peripherally after a moment and flashed me a smile of about 1.21 gigawatts. I quickly reflected that the Diamondback's bullpen had been remarkably shoddy last season, and they had better find a solution before spring training began. Be it be thanked, Granuel was now fully dressed and seemed unaware that she made me dizzy at times. A couple of ASU professors were drinking tea at one of the tables and talking politics. A small, hairy man amused me for a while with the questions he asked Perry. First, he wanted to find something about the Elder Gods. He'd clearly been reading too much Lovecraft. Then he wanted a book about howling dervishes, not whirling dervishes, and then wondered if we stocked anything about the mysteries of the Rosicrucians. Perry showed him what we had in each case, but nothing seemed to satisfy him, and he finally purchased only a dollar's worth of sandalwood incense. Such is life in retail.
Three people are coming in around 4 o'clock for interviews,
Granuel said as I began making sachets of my most popular teas.
They all sound inordinately excited about ringing up books and boiling water.
It's a glamorous career, no doubt about it, I replied.
Are you missing Rulabula already?
A little bit, she admitted. Not that you're not keeping me busy.
She waved at the computer screen that was coaching her on conjugating some Latin verbs.
I just miss the people and the atmosphere.
Me too, I said. Think they'd let you come back and work once a week and let me come back and spend my money there? Granuel shrugged.
I can ask.
Do please. Oberon and I are missing the fish and chips. The bells above the shop door chimed, and two rare sights entered my shop. I think my mouth may have dropped open. A tall, lanky, elderly gentleman with a high forehead and round spectacles, dressed in black save for a white priest collar, was followed by a shorter, younger, rounder fella in traditional Hasidic garb. Perry greeted them with a friendly hello, and the older fellow immediately asked to see the proprietor.
"That would be me," I said. "Good afternoon, gentlemen. Is this a joke?"
"I beg your pardon,"
the older fellow inquired politely, a faint smile on his narrow face. He sounded like an English butler. You know, a tall priest and a short rabbi walk into a pagan bookstore.
What?
He looked down at his companion, seeming to realize for the first time that he was quite a bit shorter and, in fact, of a different religious order than he.
Oh, gracious. I suppose it must seem amusing at that.
He didn't seem amused, though.
How may I help you today? I asked.
Yes. Well, I am Father Gregory Fletcher, and this is the Rabbi Yosef Zalman Bialik. We were hoping to speak to Atticus O'Sullivan.
Well, hope no more, I grinned at them. You're talking to him.
I laid on the college kid's informality pretty thick. These fellows didn't look right to me, and until I knew what they were after, they weren't going to see anything but the facade I presented to the general public. Their auras were perfectly human, but they churned with lust. Not the carnal kind, rather the lust for power, and that wasn't consistent with peaceful men of God. Plus, the rabbi's aura betrayed the slim, white interference of a magic user.
Oh, I beg your pardon. You seem rather young for a man of your reputation.
I didn't know I had a reputation amongst the clergy.
In some
The priest paused, searching for the right word, then continued.
Small circles, we have heard of you.
Really? What kind of circles?
Father Gregory ignored my query and responded with another.
Well, if you'll forgive the direct question, were you involved in an unusual situation in the Superstition Mountains about 3 weeks ago?
I looked blankly at him and then at the rabbi and told a whopper.
Nope. Never been out there.
On the Gavarit Pravdu,
the rabbi said in Russian, speaking for the first time.
He is not telling the truth.
Father Gregory responded fluently in the same language, telling Yosef to be quiet and let him handle things. If they thought I couldn't understand Russian, I didn't want to disabuse them of the notion.
Hey, I'm an American, I said, and the only language I speak is English, and not too good neither. When you speak that other stuff, it makes me think you're saying something rude about me.
I beg your pardon, Father Gregory said. Were you perhaps at Skyline High School this morning?
That question nearly triggered a flare of my nostrils. It took me to new heights of paranoia, and I struggled to maintain my mask of indifference. I knew that word of Angus Oak's death had gotten around, but nobody should know about the fallen angel yet except Coyote and the Virgin Mary, and I hardly thought either of them would stop to chat with these guys.
I shook my head.
I don't even know where that is. Been here all day.
I see,
Father Gregory said, clearly disappointed. Rabbi Yosef was seething silently and turning a bit red. He knew I was shoveling shit on their boots. The priest decided to change the subject.
I've heard you have quite the rare book collection. May I see it?
Of course. North wall, over there.
I pointed to a group of large china cabinets full of books, all locked away and lacking any recognizable organization. The rare book trade is another part of my business Perry can't handle. But there's so little commerce in that area that no one complains when I'm not around to handle it. The books I have are extraordinarily rare, as in there are only 1 to 10 copies in existence, because they're handwritten grimoires and scrolls full of real, honest-to-dagda spells and rituals for magical masters only. I also kept many historical secrets in there, secrets that would be a bugle call for Indiana Jones and his ilk, like the supposedly lost Sotomayor manuscript. I nearly geeked out just thinking about it being there. Pedro de Sotomayor was the scribe for Don Garcia Lopez de Cardenas, a lieutenant of Coronado's who took 80 days to make a 2-week trip to the Grand Canyon. Garcia is famous today for being the first European to see the Grand Canyon, but according to Sotomayor, they found a gigantic hoard of Aztec gold that the Tuzayans, now known as the Hopi tribe, were keeping in trust for their southern friends under assault by Cortez. Garcia and his dirty dozen took the hoard and hid it, and Sotomayor wrote it all down because they planned to come back and get it later, cutting Coronado out of the deal. None of them ever made it back to the New World, however, and Sotomayor's manuscript didn't survive. So history only has the word of Castañeda, a guy who didn't go with Garcia and knew nothing about what really happened, that they found nothing but a geological wonder after nearly 3 months. The gold is still there, on the Hopi Reservation, and nobody's looking for it. I like knowing secrets like that, and I admit that when I'm all alone in the shop sometimes, I rub my hands together greedily and laugh like a one-eyed black-mustached pirate to think that I have a bona fide treasure map locked up in my cabinet. The cabinet looked fragile, but it was a customized job. Behind the wood veneer, there was steel plate, and the glass was bulletproof. It was vacuum sealed to prevent the further decay of the paper and bindings, and the locks opened by magic only. Around the entire thing, I had set my strongest protective wards, and of course, there were more wards around my entire shop. The priest and rabbi strolled over there, hands clasped behind their backs, to peruse what I had on display. They would most likely be disappointed.
Writers of spell books do not emblazon the spines with easy-to-read titles. Granuaile caught my eye as I moved to follow them, and I put a finger to my lips and then mouthed at her, "Later." Perry had already lost interest and was back to restocking the shelves.
"What sort of books do you have here, Mr. O'Sullivan?"
Father Gregory asked when I came to a stop beside him, regarding the cabinet.
"Oh, all sorts," I said. "Can you give me an example of what I might be looking at?"
the priest asked, gesturing toward a volume bound in the gray skin of cats. It was an Egyptian text written by Bast cultists, which I'd saved from Alexandria. If I waved that in front of a museum curator, he'd promptly lose control of his salivary glands. "It's really not a section open for browsing," I replied.
"My dear boy,"
the priest chortled in an avuncular manner,
"how do you expect to sell any of it if you won't let customers peruse your catalog?"
I shrugged. "Most of it's not for sale." I sold one purely historical work per year at auction, and that gave Third Eye a healthy balance sheet, even if I lost money on the bulk of the store's business. I look at myself as more of a caretaker.
"I see. And how did you come to take care of such a collection?"
"Inherited it from my family," I said. "If there's a certain title you're looking for, I can see if I have it, or maybe I can get it for you." The priest looked at the rabbi, and the rabbi shook his head briefly. I could see they were getting ready to make excuses and leave, but I wanted to know a little more about them. I slipped in between them and the cabinet, uncomfortably close. They took a step back, and I crossed my arms in front of my chest. "Why did you come here today, gentlemen?" I said, a challenge in my tone. I let the vapid college kids slough away just a wee bit, and they noticed. Father Gregory looked flustered and began to stammer. The rabbi was not so easily rattled. He glared at me and said coolly in English with a telltale Russian accent,
"You can hardly expect us to be candid with you when you have not been candid with us."
"You haven't earned it. You're strangers and you refuse to answer my questions."
"You answer ours with lies,"
the rabbi hissed. Such an affable fella. "Perhaps I'd tell you what you want to hear if I knew you didn't mean me any harm." Father Gregory tried to be avuncular again.
"My dear boy, we are both men of the cloth,
who have wandered into a New Age bookstore asking strange personal questions," I interrupted. "And look, you could have gotten those costumes anywhere right after Halloween." Both of them registered shock at the suggestion they were not truly clergymen. So that was one question answered. I should be able to find them on the internet somewhere if they were legit. Father Gregory clasped his hands together in a prayerful attitude.
"I do apologize, Mr. O'Sullivan. It appears we have started off on the wrong foot. My colleague and I represent certain interests who believe you may be able to advance their agenda."
I crinkled my brow in confusion. Advance their agenda? Well, I have a website. I could put up a banner or something if they're looking for publicity.
"No, no, you misunderstand." "Purposely misunderstand, you mean?"
The rabbi spat.
"Come on, Gregory. This is a waste of time."
He pulled at the priest's arm and stalked off toward the exit. Father Gregory shot me an apologetic look and followed the rabbi, looking defeated. I let them go because I had research to do. They clearly knew more about me than I knew about them, and that's an extremely uncomfortable feeling for an old druid.
"What was that all about?"
Granuaile asked as I rejoined her behind the apothecary counter.
"Don't know," I shook my head. "But I'm going to find out soon."
I brooded and busied myself with preparing tea blends until it was time for interviews. The first two candidates were semi-sentient boys who stared at me with their mouths open whenever I was talking. Their eyes were dead and never lit up until I asked them if they liked video games.
they'd probably have difficulty alphabetizing. Rebecca Dane, the third candidate, was refreshing. She had a strong chin and large eyes that she had seen fit to accentuate with Betty Boop eyelashes. Her blonde hair fell to her shoulders,